splendid new enthusiasm for religious art and architecture, I knew that I was rediscovering religion as well. Do not suppose I was becoming religious. The Presbyterianism of my childhood effectively insulated me against any enthusiastic abandonment to faith. But I became aware that in matters of religion I was an illiterate, and illiteracy was my abhorrence. I was not such a fool or an aesthete as to suppose that all this art was for art's sake alone. It was about something, and I wanted to know what that something was. As an historian by training, I suppose I should have begun at the beginning, wherever that was, but I hadn't time. Scenes from the Bible gave me no difficulty. I could spot Jael spiking Sisera, or Judith with the head of Holofernes, readily enough. It was the saints who baffled me. So I got to work on them as best I could, and pretty soon knew that the old fellow with the bell was Anthony Abbott, and the same old fellow with hobgoblins plaguing him was Anthony being tempted in the desert. Sebastian, that sanctified porcupine, was easy, and so was Saint Roche with the dog and a bad leg. I was innocently delighted to meet Saint Martin, dividing his cloak on a Swiss coin. The zest for detail that had first made me want to be a polymath stood me in good stead now, for I could remember the particular attributes and symbols of scores of saints without any trouble, and I found their legends delightful reading. I became disgustingly proud, and began to whore after rare and difficult saints, not known to the Catholic faithful generally. I could read and speak French, though never without a betraying accent, and was pretty handy in Latin, so that Italian could be picked up on the run, badly, but enough. German was what I needed, and I determined to acquire it during the coming winter. I had no fear. Whatever interested me, I could learn, and learn quickly. At this time, it never occurred to me that the legends I picked up were quite probably about people who had once lived and had done something or other that made them popular and dear after death. What I learned merely revived and confirmed my childhood notion that religion was much nearer in spirit to the Arabian Nights than it was to anything encouraged by St. James's Presbyterian Church. I wondered how they would regard it in Deptford if I offered to replace the captive dove that sat on the topmost organ pipe with St. James's own cockle shell. I was foolish and conceited, I know, but I was also a happy goat who had wandered into the wondrous enclosed garden of hagiology, and I grazed greedily and contentedly. When the time came at last for me to go home, I knew I had found a happiness that would endure. 5. Schoolmastering kept me busy by day and part of each night. I was an assistant housemaster with a fine big room under the eaves of the main building and a wretched kennel of a bedroom, and rights in a bathroom used by two or three other resident masters. I taught all day, but my wooden leg mercifully spared me from the nuisance of having to supervise sports after school. There were exercises to mark every night, but I soon gained a professional attitude towards these woeful explorations of the caves of ignorance, and did not let them depress me. I liked the company of most of my colleagues, who were about equally divided among good men who were good teachers, awful men who were awful teachers, and the grotesques and misfits who drift into teaching and are so often the most educative influences a boy meets in school. If a boy can't have a good teacher, give him a psychological cripple or an exotic failure to cope with. Don't just give him a bad, dull teacher. This is where the private schools score over state-run schools. They can accommodate a few cultured madmen on the staff without having to offer explanations. The boys liked me for my wooden leg, whose thuds in the corridor gave ample warning of my approach and allowed smokers, loafers, and dreamers, these last two groups are not the same, to do whatever was necessary before I arrived. I had now taken to using a cane, except when I was very much on parade, and a swipe with my heavy stick over the behind was preferred by all sensible boys to a tedious imposition. I may have been the despair of educational psychologists, but I knew boys, and I knew my stuff, and it quickly began to show up in examination results. Boy Staunton was also distinguishing himself as an educator. He was educating Leola, and as I saw them pretty regularly, I was able to estimate his success. He wanted to make her into the perfect wife for a rising young entrepreneur in sugar, for he was working hard and fast, and now had a foot in the world of soft drinks, candy, and confectionery. He had managed brilliantly on a principle so simple that it deserves to be recorded. He set up a little company of his own by borrowing $5,000 for 4 months. As he already had $5,000, it was no trouble to repay the loan. Then he borrowed $10,000 and repaid with promptitude. On this principle, he quickly established an excellent reputation, always paying promptly, though never prematurely, thereby robbing his creditor of expected interest. Bank managers grew to love Boy, but he soon gave up dealing with branches and borrowed only at head office. He was now a favored cherub in the heaven of finance, and he needed a wife who could help him to graduate from a cherub to a full-fledged angel, and, as soon as possible, to an archangel. So Leola had lessons in tennis and bridge, learned not to call her maid the girl, even to herself, and had no children as the time was not yet at hand. She was prettier than ever, had acquired a sufficient command of cliché to be able to talk smartly about anything Boy's friends were likely to know, and adored Boy while fearing him a little. He was so swift, so brilliant, so handsome. I think she was always a little puzzled to find that she was really his wife. It was in 1927 that Boy's first instance of startling good fortune arrived. One of those coincidences that it may be wiser to call synchronicities, which aid the ambitious. Something that heaved him at a stroke into a higher sphere and maintained him there. He had kept up with his regiment and soldiered regularly. He had thoughts of politics, he told me, and a militia connection would earn a lot of votes. So when the Prince of Wales made his tour of Canada that year, who was more personable, youthful, cheerful, and in every way suited to be one of His Highness's aides-de-camp than Boy Staunton? And not simply for the royal appearance in Toronto, but for the duration of the tour, from sea to sea. I saw little of this grandeur, except when the prince paid a visit to the school, for as it has royal patronage, he was obliged to do so. We masters all turned out in our gowns and hoods, and sweating members of the rifle corps strutted and yelled and swooned from the heat, and the slight descendant of King Arthur and King Alfred and Charles II did the gracious. I was presented, with my VC pinned to the silk of my gown, but my recollection is not of the youthful prince, but of Boy, who was quite the most gorgeous figure there that day. An old boy of the school and an aide to the prince. It was a great day for him, and the headmaster of that day doted upon him to a degree that might have seemed a little overdone to a critical eye. Leola was there, too, for though of course she did not go with Boy on the tour, she was expected to turn up now and then at various points across Canada, just as though she happened to be there by chance. She had learned to curtsy very prettily, not easy in the skirts of the period, and eat without seeming to chew, and do other courtier-like things required by Boy. I am sure that for her the prince was nothing more than an excuse for Boy's brilliant appearances. Never have I seen a woman so absorbed in her love for a man, and I was happy for her and heartily wished her well. After the prince had gone home, the Stauntons settled down again to be, in a modest manner befitting their youth, social leaders. Boy had a lot of new social usages and took to wearing spats to business. For him and for Leola, their jazz age period was over. Now they were serious, responsible young marrieds. Within a year, their first child was born and was conservatively but significantly christened Edward David. In due time, how could HRH have known? A christening mug came from Mappin and Webb, with the three feathers and Ich Dien on it. David used it until he graduated to a cup and saucer, after which it stood on the drawing-room table with matches in it, quite casually. 6. Doc Staunton and his wife never visited Boy and Leola on what I suppose must be called religious grounds. When they came to Toronto, which was rarely, they asked the young Stauntons to their hotel, the cheap and conservative Carl's Right, for a meal, but declined to set foot in a house where drink was consumed, contrary to the law of the land and against God's manifest will. Another stone that stuck in their crop was that Boy and Leola had left the Presbyterian Church and become Anglicans. In a movement that reached its climax in 1924, the Presbyterians and Methodists had consummated a mysterium conjunctionis that resulted in the United Church of Canada, with a doctrine smoother than the creamy curd, in which the harshness of Presbyterianism and the hick piety of Methodism had little part. A few brass-boweled Presbyterians and some truly zealous Methodists held out, but a majority regarded this union as a great victory for Christ's kingdom on earth. Unfortunately, it also involved some haggling between the rich Presbyterians and the poor Methodists, which roused the mocking spirit of the rest of the country. The Catholics in particular had some Irish jokes about the biggest land and property grab in Canadian history. During this uproar, a few sensitive souls fled to the embrace of Anglicanism. The envious and disaffected said they did it because the Anglican Church was in some way more high-toned than the evangelical faiths, and thus they were improving their social standing. At that time, every Canadian had to adhere, nominally, to some church. The officials of the census utterly refused to accept such terms as agnostic or none for inclusion in the column marked religion, and flattering statistics were compiled on the basis of census reports that gave a false idea of the forces all the principal faiths could command. Boy and Leola had moved quietly into a fashionable Anglican church where the rector, Canon Arthur Woodywiss, was so broad-minded he did not even insist that they be confirmed. David was confirmed, though, when his time came, and so was Caroline, who appeared a well-planned 2 years after him. My preoccupation with saints was such that I could not keep it out of my conversation, and Boy was concerned for me. "Watch that you don't get queer, Dunny," he would say sometimes, and "Arthur Woodywiss says that saints are all right for Catholics, who have so many ignorant people to deal with, but we've evolved far beyond all that." As a result, I sneaked even more saints into my conversation to irritate him. He had begun to irritate rather easily and be pompous. He urged me to get out of schoolmastering, while praising it as a fine profession, and make something of myself. "If you don't hurry up and let life know what you want, life will damn soon show you what you'll get," he said one day. But I was not sure I wanted to issue orders to life. I rather liked the Greek notion of allowing chance to take a formative hand in my affairs. It was in the autumn of 1928 that chance did so, and lured me from a broad highway to a narrower path. Our headmaster of that day, your predecessor but one, was enthusiastic for what he called bringing the world to the school and the school to the world, and every Wednesday morning he had a special speaker at prayers who told us about what he did in the world. Sir Archibald Flower told us about rebuilding the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre at Stratford-on-Avon, and got a dollar from nearly every boy to help do it. Father Jellicoe talked about clearing London slums, and that cost most of us a dollar, too. But ordinarily our speakers were Canadians, and one morning the headmaster swept in. He wore a silk gown, well suited to sweeping, with Mr. Joel Surgener in tow. Surgener was already pretty well known, though I had not seen him before. He was the head of the Lifeline Mission in Toronto, where he labored to do something for destitute and defeated people, and for the sailors on the boats that plied the Great Lakes, at that time a very tough and neglected group. He spoke to the school briefly and well, for though it was plain that he was a man of little education, he had a compelling quality of sincerity about him, even though I suspected him of being a pious liar. He told us, quietly and in the simplest language, that he had to run his mission by begging, and that sometimes begging yielded nothing. When this happened, he prayed for help, and he had never been refused what he needed. The blankets, or more often the food, would appear, somehow, often late in the day, and more often than not, left on the steps of the mission by anonymous donors. Now, pompous young ass that I was quite prepared to believe that St. John Bosco could pull off this trick when he appealed to heaven on behalf of his boys. I was even persuaded that it might have happened a few times to Dr. Barnardo, of whom the story was also told. But I was far too much a Canadian deeply, if unconsciously, convinced of the inferiority of my own country and its people, to think it could happen in Toronto to a man I could see. I suppose I had a sneer on my face. Sergeant's back was to me, but suddenly he turned and addressed me.
"I can see that you do not believe me, sir," he said, "but I am speaking the truth, and if you will come down to the lifeline some night, I will show you clothes and blankets and food that God has inspired charitable men and women to give us to do his work among his forgotten children."
This had an electrical effect. A few boys laughed, the headmaster gave me a glance that singed my eyebrows, and Surgener's concluding remarks were greeted with a roar of applause. But I had no time to waste in being humiliated, for when Surgener looked me in the face, I knew him at once for the tramp I had last seen in the pit at Deptford. I lost no time. I was at the Lifeline mission that very night. It was on the ground floor of a warehouse down by the lakefront. Everything about it was poor. The lower parts of the windows were painted over with green paint, and the lettering on them, "Lifeline Mission, come in," was an amateur job. Inside, the electric light was scanty and eked out by a couple of coal oil lamps on the table at the front. On benches made of reclaimed wood sat 8 or 10 people, of whom 4 or 5 were bums, and the rest poor but respectable supporters of Surgener. A service was in progress. Surgener was praying. He needed a variety of things, the only one of which I can remember was a new kettle for soup, and he suggested to God that the woodpile was getting low. When he had, so to speak, put in his order, he began to speak to us, gently and unassumingly as he had done at the school that morning, and I was able to observe now that he had a hearing aid in his left ear, one of the clumsy affairs then in use, and that a cord ran down into his collar and appeared to join a bulge in the front of his shirt, obviously a receiving apparatus. But his voice was pleasant and well-controlled, nothing like the ungoverned quack of many deaf people. He saw me, of course, and nodded gravely. I expected that he would try to involve me in his service, probably to score off me as an educated infidel and mocker, but he did not. Instead, he told, very simply, of his experience with a lake sailor who was a notable blasphemer, a man whose every remark carried an insult to God's name. Surgener had been powerless to change him, and had left him in defeat. One day, Surgener had talked with an old woman, desperately poor but rich in the spirit of Christ, who had at parting pressed into his hand a cent, the only coin she had to give. Surgener bought a tract with the cent and carried it absent-mindedly in his pocket for several weeks, until by chance he met the blasphemer again. On impulse, he pressed the tract upon the blasphemer, who of course received it with an oath. Surgener thought no more of the matter until, 2 months later, he met the blasphemer again, this time a man transfigured. He had read the tract, he had accepted Christ, and he had begun life anew. I fully expected that it would prove that the old woman was the blasphemer's aged mother, and that the two had been reunited in love, but Surgener did not go so far. Was this the self-denying chastity of the literary artist, I wondered, or had he not thought of such a denouement yet? When the meeting had concluded with a dismal rendition of the revival hymn, "Throw out the lifeline, throw out the lifeline, someone is drifting away. Throw out the lifeline, throw out the lifeline, someone is sinking today," sung with the dispirited drag of the unaccompanied, untalented religious, the little group drifted away. The bums to the sleeping quarters next door, and the respectable to their homes, and I was alone with Joel Surgener.
"Well, sir, I knew you would come, but I didn't expect you so soon," said he, and gestured me into a kitchen chair by the table. He frugally turned off the electricity, and we sat in the light of the lamps. "You promised to show me what prayer had brought," I said.
"You see it around you," he replied, and then, seeing surprise on my face at the wretchedness of the mission, he led me to a door into the next room. It was in fact a double door running on a track of the kind you see in old warehouses, and slid it back. In the gloom leaking down through an overhead skylight, I saw a poor dormitory in which about 50 men were lying on cots. Prayer brings me these, and prayer and hard work and steady begging provide for them, Mr. Ramsay. I suppose he had learned my name at the school. I spoke to our bursar tonight, I said, and your talk this morning will bring you a check for $543, from 600 boys and a staff of about 30. That's not bad. What will you do with it?
Winter is coming. It will buy a lot of warm underclothes.
He closed the sliding door, and we sat down again in what seemed to be the chapel, common room, and business office of the mission.
That check will probably be a week getting here, and our needs are daily. Hourly. Here is the collection from our little meeting tonight.
He showed me 13 cents on a cracked saucer. I decided it was time to go at him.
13 cents for a 13-cent talk, I said. Did you expect them to believe that cock-and-bull story about the cursing sailor and the widow's mite? Don't you underestimate them?
He was not disconcerted.
I expect them to believe the spirit of the story, he said, and I know from experience what kind of story they like. You educated people, you have a craze for what you call truth, by which you mean police court facts. These people get their noses rubbed in such facts all day and every day, and they don't want to hear them from me.
So you provide romance, I said.
I provide something that strengthens faith, Mr. Ramsay, as well as I can. I am not a gifted speaker or a man of education, and often my stories come out thin and old, and I suppose unbelievable to a man like you. These people don't hold me on oath, and they aren't stupid either. They know my poor try at a parable from hard fact, and I won't deceive you. There is something about this kind of work and the kind of lives these people live that knocks the hard edge off fact. If you think I'm a liar, and you do, you should hear some of the confessions that come out in this place on a big night. Awful whoppers that just pop into the heads of people who have found joy in faith but haven't got past wanting to be important in the world. So they blow up their sins like balloons. Better people than them want to seem worse than they are. We come to God in little steps, not in a leap, and that love of police court truth you think so much of comes very late on the way, if it comes at all. What is truth? As Pilate asked. I've never pretended that I could have told him. I'm just glad when a boozer sobers up, or a man stops beating his woman, or a crooked lad tries to go straight. If it makes him boast a bit, that's not the worst harm it can do. You unbelieving people apply cruel, hard standards to us who believe.
What makes you think I'm an unbeliever? I said. And what made you turn on me this morning in front of the whole school?
I admit it was a trick, he said. When you are talking like that, it's always a good job near the end to turn on somebody and accuse them of disbelieving. Sometimes you see somebody laughing, but that isn't needful. Best of all is to turn on somebody behind you, if you can. Make it look as if you had eyes in the back of your head, see? There's a certain amount of artfulness about it, of course, but a greater end has been served, and nobody has been really hurt.
That's a thoroughly crooked-minded attitude, said I.
Perhaps it is, but you're not the first man I've used like that, and I promise you won't be the last. God has to be served, and I must use the means I know. If I'm not false to God, and I try very hard not to be, I don't worry too much about the occasional stranger.
I am not quite so much a stranger as you think, said I. Then I told him that I had recognized him. I don't know what I expected him to do, deny it, I suppose, but he was perfectly cool.
I don't remember you, of course, he said. I don't remember anybody from that night except the woman herself. It was her that turned me to God.
When you raped her.
I didn't rape her, Mr. Ramsay. You heard her say so herself. Not that I wouldn't have done, the state of mind I was in. I was at the end of my rope. I was a tramp, you see. Any idea what it means to be a tramp? They're lost men. Not many people understand them.
Do you know, I've heard and read such nonsense about how they just can't stand the chains of civilization and have to breathe the air of freedom, and a lot of them are educated men with a wonderful philosophy, and they laugh at the hard workers and farmers they beg off of. Well, it's all a lot of cock, as they'd put it. They're madmen and criminals and degenerates, mostly, and tramping makes them worse. It's the open-air life does it to them. Oh, I know the open air is a great thing when you have food and shelter to go back to. But when you haven't, it drives you mad. Starvation and oxygen is a crazy mixture for anybody that isn't born to it, like a savage. These fellows aren't savages. Weaklings, mostly, but vicious. I got among them a very common way. Know-it-all lad, quarreled with my old dad, who was hard and mean religious. Ran away, picked up odd jobs, then began to pinch stuff, and got on the drink. Know what a tramp drinks? Shoe-blacking, sometimes, strained through a hunk of bread. Drives you crazy. Or he gets a few prunes and lets them stand in the sun in a can till they ferment. That's the stuff gives you the black pukes taken on a stomach with nothing in it but maybe some raw vegetables you've pulled in a field. Like those sugar beets around Deptford. Fermented for a while, they'd eat a hole in a copper pot. And sex, too. Funny how fierce it gets when the body is ill-fed and ill-used. Tramps are sodomites, mostly. I was a young fellow, and it's the young ones and the real old ones that get used, because they can't fight as well. It's not kid-glove stuff like that Englishman went to prison for. It's enough to kill you, you'd think, when a gang of tramps set on a young fellow. But it doesn't, you know. That's how I lost my hearing, most of it. I resisted a gang, and they beat me over the ears with my own boots till I couldn't resist any more. Do you know what they say? Lots of booze and buggery, they say. That's their life. Mine, too, till the great mercy of that woman. I know now that God is just as near them as he is to you and me at this instant. But they defy him, poor souls. That night, we last met, I was crazy. I'd tumbled off the freight in that jungle by Deptford and found a fire and seven fellows around it, and they had a stew. Somebody'd got a rabbit, and it was in a pail over a fire with some carrots. Ever eat that? It's awful. But I wanted some, and after a lot of nastiness, they said I could have some after they'd had what they wanted of me. My manhood just couldn't stand it, and I left them. They laughed and said I'd be back when I got good and hungry. Then I met this woman, wandering by herself. I knew she was a town woman. Women tramps are very rare. Too much sense, I guess. She was clean and looked like an angel to me, but I threatened her and asked her for money. She hadn't any. Then I grabbed her. She wasn't much afraid and asked what I wanted. I told her in tramp's language, and I could see she didn't understand. But when I started to push her down and grab at her clothes, she said, "Why are you so rough?" And then I started to cry. She held my head to her breast and talked nicely to me, and I cried worse. But the strange thing is I still wanted her. As if only that would put me right, you see? That's what I said to her. And do you know what she said? She said, "You may if you promise not to be rough." So I did. And that was when you people came hunting her. When I look back now, I wonder that it wasn't all over with me that moment. But it wasn't. No, it was glory come into my life. It was as if I had gone right down into hell, and through the worst of the fire, and come on a clear, pure pool, where I could wash and be clean. I was locked in by my deafness, so I didn't know much of what was said, but I could see it was a terrible situation for her, and there was nothing I could do. They turned me loose next morning, and I ran out of that town, laughing and shouting like the man who was delivered from devils by our Lord. As I had been, you see. He worked through that woman, and she is a blessed saint, for what she did for me, I mean it as I say it, was a miracle. Where is she now? How did I know? Mrs. Dempster was often in my mind, but whenever I thought of her, I put the thought aside with a sick heart as part of a past that was utterly done. I had tried to get Deptford out of my head, just as Boy had done, and for the same reason. I wanted a new life. What Surgener told me made it clear that any new life must include Deptford. There was to be no release by muffling up the past. We talked for some time, and I liked him more and more. When at last I left, I laid a $10 bill on the table.
"Thank you, Mr. Ramsay," said he. "This will get us the soup kettle we need, and a load of wood as well. Do you see now how prayers are answered?"
7. Back to Deptford, therefore, at the first chance, pretending I wanted to consult Mr. Mahaffey about the deadbeat who had bought the banner from me and was still in debt for more than half of the price. The magistrate counseled patience, but I got what I wanted, which was the address of the aunt who had taken Mrs. Dempster after the death of her husband. She was not, as Milo Papel thought, a widow, but an old maid, a Miss Bertha Shanklin, and she lived in Weston. He gave me the address, without asking why I wanted it. "A bad business, that was," he said. "She seemed a nice little person. Then, a madwoman. Struck by a snowball. I don't suppose you have any idea who threw it, have you?" "No, I didn't imagine you did, or you would have said so earlier. There was guilt, you know. Undoubtedly, there was guilt. I don't know quite what could have been done about it, but look at the consequences. McCausland says, definitely, she became a moral idiot. No sense at all of right and wrong. And the result was that terrible business in the pit. I remember that you were there. And the ruin of her husband's life. Then the lad running away when he was really no more than a baby. I've never seen such grief as hers when she finally realized he had gone. McCausland had to give her very heavy morphia before Miss Shanklin could remove her. Yes, there was guilt, whether any kind of charge could have been laid or not. Guilt, and somebody bears it to this day." The old man's vehemence, and the way he kept looking at me over and under and around his small, very dirty spectacles, left no doubt that he thought I knew more than I admitted, and might very well be the guilty party myself. But I saw no sense in telling him anything. I still had a grudge against Boy for what he had done. But I remembered, too, that if I had not been so sly, Mrs. Dempster would not have been hit. I was anxious to regard the whole thing as an accident, past care and past grief. Nevertheless, this conversation reheated my strong sense of guilt and responsibility about Paul. The war and my adult life had banked down that fire, but not quenched it. The consequence was that I did something very foolish. I paid a visit to Father Regan, who was still the Catholic priest in Deptford. I had never spoken to him, but I wanted somebody I could talk to confidentially, and I had the Protestant notion that priests are very closed-mouthed and see more than they say. Later in life I got over that idea. But at this moment I wanted somebody who was in Deptford, but not wholly of it, and he seemed to be my man. So within 15 minutes of leaving the magistrate, I was in the priest's house, snuffing up the smell of soap, and sitting in one of those particularly uncomfortable chairs that find refuge in priests' parlors all over the globe. He thought, quite rightly, that I had come fishing for something, and was very suspicious, but when he found out what it was, he laughed aloud, with the creaky, short laugh of a man whose life does not afford many jokes. "A saint, do you say? Well, now, that's a pretty tall order. I couldn't help you at all. Finding saints isn't any part of my job. Nor can I say what's a miracle and what isn't. But I don't imagine the bishop would have much to say to your grounds. It'd be his job to think of such things, if anybody did. A tramp reformed. I've reformed a tramp or two myself. They get spells of repentance, like most people. This fella you tell me of now seems to be as extreme in his zeal as he was in his sin. I never like that. And this business of raising your brother from his deathbed, as you describe it, was pretty widely talked about when it happened. Dr. McCausland says he never died at all, and I suppose he'd know. A few minutes with no signs of life. Well, that's hardly Lazarus now, is it? And your own experience when you were wounded. Man, you were out of your head, I have to say it plainly. You'd better put this whole foolish notion away and forget it. You are always an imaginative young fella. It was said of you when you were a lad, and it seems you haven't changed.
You have to watch that kind of thing, you know. Now, you tell me you're very interested in saints. All right, I'm not fishing for converts, but if that's the way it is, you'd better take a good look at the religion saints come from. And when you've looked, I'll bet you a dollar you'll draw back like a man from a flame. You clever, imaginative fellas often want to flirt with Mother Church, but she's no flirty lady, I'm telling you. You like the romance, but you can't bear the yoke. You're hypnotized by this idea that three miracles makes a saint, and you think you've got three miracles for a poor woman who is far astray in her wits and don't know right from wrong. Ah, gone. Look, Mr. Ramsay, I'll tell it to you as plain as it comes. There's a lot of very good people in the world, and a lot of queer things happen that we don't see the explanation of. But there's only one church that undertakes to cut right down to the bone and say what's a miracle and what isn't, and who's a saint and who isn't. And you, and this poor soul you speak of, are outside it. You can't set up some kind of a bootleg saint. So take my advice and cut it out. Be content with the facts you have, or think you have, and don't push anything too far, or you might get a bit strange yourself. I'm trying to be kind, you know, for I admired your parents. Fine people, and your father was a fair-minded man to every faith. But there are spiritual dangers you Protestants don't even seem to know exist, and this monkeying with difficult, sacred things is a sure way to get yourself into a real old mess. Well, I recall, when I was a seminarian, how we were warned one day about a creature called a fool saint. Ever hear of a fool saint? I thought not. As a matter of fact, it's a Jewish idea, and the Jews are no fools, you know. A fool saint is somebody who seems to be full of holiness, and loves everybody, and does every good act he can. But because he's a fool, it all comes to nothing, to worse than nothing, because it is virtue tainted with madness, and you can't tell where it'll end up. Did you know that prudence was named as one of the virtues? There's the trouble with your fool saint, you see. No prudence. Nothing but a lot of bad luck'll rub off on you from one of them. Did you know bad luck could be catching? There's a theological name for it, but I misremember it right now. Yes, I know a lot of the saints have done strange things, but I don't recall any of them traipsing through the streets with a basket full of wilted lettuce and wormy spuds, or bringing scandal on their town by shameless goings-on. No. No, the poor soul is a fool saint, if she's anything, and I'd strongly advise you to keep clear of her. So back to Toronto with a flea in my ear and advice from Father Regan so obviously good and kind that I had either to take it or else hate Regan for giving it. Knowing by now what a high-stomached fellow I was, you can guess which I did. Within a week, I was at Weston, talking with my fool saint once again. 8. She was now 40, but looked younger. An unremarkable woman, really, except for great sweetness of expression. Her dress was simple, and I suppose the aunt chose it, for it was a good deal longer than the fashion of the time, and had a homemade air. She had no recollection of me to begin with, but when I spoke of Paul, I roused painful associations, and the aunt had to intervene and take her away. The aunt had not wanted to let me in the house, and as I thought this might be so, I presented myself at the door without warning. Miss Bertha Shanklin was very small, of an unguessable age, and had gentle, countrified manners. Her house was pretty and suggested an old-fashioned sort of cultivation. Much was ugly in the style of 50 years before, but nothing was trashy. There were a few mosaic boxes and a couple of muddy oil paintings of the Italian Campania with classical ruins and picturesque peasants, which suggested that somebody had been to Italy. Miss Shanklin let me talk with Mrs. Dempster for 10 minutes or so before she took her away. I stayed where I was, though decency suggested that it was time for me to go.
"I am sure you mean this visit kindly, Mr. Ramsay," she said when she returned. "But you can see for yourself that my niece is not up to receiving callers. There's not a particle of sense in reminding her of the days past. It frets her and does no good. So I'll say good afternoon and thank you for calling."
I talked as well as I could about why I had come, and of my concern for her niece, to whom I owed a great debt. I said nothing of saints. That was not Miss Shankland's line. But I talked about childhood kindness, and my mother's concern for Mary Dempster, and my sense of guilt that I had not sought her before. This brought about a certain melting.
That's real kind of you. I know some terrible things went on in Deptford, and it's good to know not everybody has forgotten poor Mary. I suppose I can say to you that I always thought the whole affair was a mistake. Amasa Dempster was a good man, I suppose, but Mary had been used to an easier life. Not silly easy, you understand me, but at least some of the good things. I won't pretend I was friendly towards the match, and I guess I have to bear some of the blame. They didn't exactly run away, but it hurt me the way they managed things, as if there wasn't a soul in the world but themselves. I could have made it easier for her, but Amasa was so proud, and even a little mite hateful about Mary having any money of her own, that I just said, all right, they can paddle their own canoe. It cost me a good deal to do that. I never saw Paul, you know, and I'd certainly have done anything in the world for him if I could have got things straight with his father. But I guess a little bit of money made me proud, and religion made him proud, and then it was too late. I love her so much, you see. She's all the family I've got. Love can make you do some mean actions when you think it has been snubbed. I was mean, I grant you, but I'm trying to do what I can now, when I guess it's too late.
Miss Shanklin wept, not aloud or passionately, but to the point of having to wipe her eyes and depart for the kitchen to ask for some tea. By the time this tea was brought by the hired girl, whose softening influence on Mary Dempster had been so deplored by the matrons of Amasa Dempster's congregation, Miss Shanklin and I were on quite good terms.
"I love to hear you say that Mary was so good and sweet, even after that terrible accident. It was an accident, wasn't it? A blow on the head, from a fall or something? And that you thought of her even when you were away at the war. I always had such hopes for her. Not just to keep her with me, of course, but— Well, I know she loved Amasa Dempster, and love is supposed to excuse anything. But I am sure there would have been other men, and she could hardly have been worse off with one of them now, could she? Life with Amasa seems to have been so dark and wintry and hopeless. Mary used to be so full of hope before she married. Now she remembers so little, and it's better so, because when she does remember, she thinks of Paul. I don't even let myself speculate on what would happen to a little fellow like that, running away with show folks. As like as not, he's dead long since, and better so, I suppose. But of course, she thinks of him as a little boy still. She has no idea of time, you see. When she thinks of him, it's awful to hear her cry and carry on. And I can't get rid of the feeling that if I had just had a little more real sand and horse sense, things would have been very different. I'd meant to tell you not to come again, ever, but I won't. Come and see Mary, but promise you'll get to know her again, as a new friend. She hasn't any idea of the past, except for horrible, mixed-up memories of being tied up and Paul disappearing and Amasa. She always remembers him with a blue mouth, like a rotten hole in his face, telling God he forgave her for ruining his life. Amasa died praying, did you know?
9. It was the following May, in the fated year 1929, that I had a call from Boy, in itself an unusual thing, but even more unusual in its message.
"Dunny, don't be in too much of a rush, but you oughtn't to lose more than a couple of weeks in getting rid of some of your things,"
and he named half a dozen stocks he knew I had, because he had himself advised me to buy them. "But they're mounting every week," I said.
"That's right," said he. "Now sell 'em, and get hold of some good hard stuff. I'll see that you get another good block of alpha."
So that is what I did, and it is to Boy's advice I owe a reputation I acquired in the school as a very shrewd businessman. Just about every master, like some millions of other people on this continent, had money in the market, and most of them had invested on margin and were cleaned out before Christmas. But I found myself pleasantly well off when the worst of the crash came, because Boy Staunton regarded me as, in certain respects, a responsibility.
My mind was not on money at the time, however, for I was waiting impatiently for the end of term, so that I could take ship and set out on a great hunt, starting in England and making my way across France, Portugal, Switzerland, Austria, and at last to Czechoslovakia. This was the first of my annual journeys, broken only by the 1939-45 war. Saint hunting, saint identifying, and saint describing. Journeys that led to my book, 100 Saints for Travelers, still in print in 6 languages, and a lively seller, to say nothing of my 9 other books and my occasional articles. This time I was after big game. A saint never satisfactorily described, and occurring in a variety of forms, whose secret I hope to discover. There is a saint for just about every human situation, and I was on the track of a curious specimen whose intercession was sought by girls who wanted to get rid of disagreeable suitors. Her home ground, so to speak, was Portugal, and she was reputed to have been the daughter of a Portuguese king, himself a pagan, who had betrothed her to the king of Sicily. But she was a Christian and had made a vow of virginity, and when she prayed for assistance in keeping it, she miraculously grew a heavy beard. The Sicilian king refused to have her, and her angry father caused her to be crucified. It was my purpose to visit every shrine of this odd saint, compare all versions of the legend, establish or demolish the authenticity of a prayer reputedly addressed to her, and authorized by a bishop of Rouen in the 16th century, and generally to poke my nose into anything that would shed light on her mystery. Her case abounded with the difficulties that people of my temperament love. She was commonly called Virgo Fortis, supposed to be derived from Virgo Fortis, but she was also honored under the names of Liberata, Cumernis, Oncomena, Livrada, and in England, she once had a shrine in St. Paul's, as Uncumber. The usual fate for Virgo Fortis, among the more conservative hagiologists, was dismissal as an ignorant peasant misunderstanding of one of the many paintings of the Holy Face of Lucca, in which a long-haired and bearded figure in a long robe hangs from a cross. It is, of course, Christ, reputedly painted by St. Luke himself, but many copies of it might well be pictures of a bearded lady. I, however, had one or two new ideas about Uncumber, which I wanted to test. The first was that her legend might be a persistence of the hermaphrodite figure of the Great Mother, which was long worshipped in Cyprus and Carthage. Many a useful and popular wonder-working figure had been pinched from the pagans by Christians in early days, and some not so early. My other bit of information came from 2 physicians at the State University of New York, Dr. Moses and Dr. Lloyd, who had published some findings about abnormal growth of hair in unusually emotional women. They instanced a number of cases of beard growing in girls who had been crossed in love. Furthermore, 2 English doctors attested to a thick beard grown by a girl whose engagement had been brutally terminated. Anything here for Uncumber? I was on my way to Europe to find out. So I jaunted cheerfully about the continent on my apparently mad mission, hunting up Uncumber in remote villages, as well as in such easy and pleasant places as Beauvais and Visson, and once positively identifying an image that was said to be Uncumber, Vilja Fort she was locally called, and the priest was rather ashamed of her, as Gala, the patroness of widows, who is also sometimes represented with a beard. It was not until August that I arrived in the Tyrol, searching for a shrine that was in a village about 35 miles northwest of Innsbruck. It was about the size of Deptford, and its 3 inns did not expect many visitors from North America. This was still before the winter sports enthusiasm opened up every Tyrolean village and forced something like modern sanitation on every inn and guest house. I settled in at the inevitable Red Horse and looked about me. I was not the only stranger in the village. A tent and some faded banners in the marketplace announced the presence of Le Grand Cirque Forain de Saint-Vite. I was certainly not the man to neglect a circus dedicated to St. Vitus, patron of traveling showmen, and still invoked in country places against chorea and palsy and, indeed, anything that made the body shake. The banners showed neither the cock nor the dog that the name of St. Vitus would have suggested, but they promised a human frog, Le Plus Grand des Tyroliens, Le Solitaire des Forêts, and Luck for Me, La Femme à Barbe. I determined to see this bearded lady, and if possible to find out if she had been violently crossed in love. As a circus, it was a pitiable affair. Everything about it stank of defeat and misery. There was no planned performance. Now and then, when a sufficient crowd had assembled, a pair of gloomy acrobats did some tumbling and walked a slack wire. The human frog sat down on his own head, but with the air of one who took no pleasure in it. The wild man roared and chewed perfunctorily on a piece of raw meat, to which a little fur still clung. The lecturer hinted darkly that we ought to keep our dogs indoors that night, but nobody seemed afraid. When not on view, the wild man sat quietly, and from the motion of his jaws, I judged that he was solacing himself with a quid of chewing tobacco. There was an achondroplasic dwarf who danced on broken bottles. His bare feet were dirty, and from repeated dancing, the glass had lost its sharpness. Their great turn was a wretched fellow, Rinaldo the Heterodelphian, who removed his robe and showed us that below his breast grew a pitiful, wobbling lump that the eye of faith, assisted by the lecturer's description, might accept as a pair of small buttocks and what could have been two little legs without feet, an imperfect twin. The bearded lady sat and knitted. Her low-cut gown, revealing the foothills of enormous breasts, dispelled any idea that she was a fake. It was upon her that I fixed my attention, for the Heterodelphian and the Frost of Tyrolean Lederhosen were trying, even for one used to a room full of schoolboys. I had had enough of Le Grand Cirque Forain de Saint-Vite and was about to leave when a young man leapt up on the platform beside Le Solitaire des Forêts and began, rapidly and elegantly, to do tricks with cards. It was Paul Dempster. I had acquiesced for some time in the opinion put forward by Mr. Mahaffey and Miss Shanklin that Paul must be dead, or certainly lost forever. Seeing him now, however, I felt no disbelief and no uncertainty. I had last seen Paul in 1915, when he was 7. 14 years later, many men would have been unrecognizably changed from child to man. But I knew him in an instant. After all, he had been my pupil in the art of manipulating cards and coins, and I had watched him very closely as he demonstrated his superiority to my clumsy self. His face had changed from child to man, but his hands and his style of using them were not to be mistaken. He gave his patter in French, dropping occasionally into German with an Austrian accent. He was very good, excellent indeed, but too good for his audience. Those among them who were card players plainly belonged to the class who play very slow games at the inns they frequent, laying down each card as if it weighed a pound and shuffling with deliberation. His rapid passes and brilliant manipulations dazzled without enlightening them. So it was when he began to work with coins. Secure and palm 6 half-crowns. The daunting phrase came to my mind again as Paul did precisely that with the big Austrian pieces, plucking them from the beards of grown men, or seeming to milk them from the noses of children, or nipping them up with long fingers from the bodices of giggling girls. It was the simplest but also the most difficult kind of conjuring, because it depended on the most delicate manual skill. He brought an elegance to it that was as good as anything I had ever seen, for my old enthusiasm had led me to see a conjurer whenever I could. When he wanted a watch to smash, I offered mine, to get his eye, but he ignored it in favor of a large silver turnip handed up by a Tyrolean of some substance. Do what I could, he would not look at me, though I was a conspicuous figure, as the only man in the audience not in local dress. When he had beaten the watch to pieces, made the pieces disappear, and invited a large countrywoman to return the watch from her knitting bag, the performance was over, and the Tyroleans moved heavily towards the door of the tent. I lingered and addressed him in English. He replied in French, and when I changed to French, he turned at once to German. I was not to be beaten. What passed between us took quite a long time, and was slow and uneasy. But in the end he admitted that he was Paul Dempster, or had been so many years before. He had been Faustus Legrand for more years than the 10 during which he answered to his earlier name. I spoke of his mother, told him that I had seen her not long before I came abroad. He did not answer. Little by little, however, I got on better terms with him, principally because the other members of the troop were curious to know what such a stranger as I wanted with one of them, and crowded around with frank curiosity. I let them know that I was from the village of Paul's birth, and with some of the cunning I had learned when trying to get priests and sacristans to talk about local shrines and the doings of saints, I let it be known that I would consider it an honor to provide the friends of Faustus Legrand with a drink, probably more than one drink. This eased up the atmosphere at once, and the bearded lady, who seemed to be the social leader of Le Grand Cirque Forain de Saint-Vite, organized a party in a very few minutes and closed the tent to business. They all, except Le Solitaire des Forêts, who had the eyes of a dope-taker, were very fond of drink, and soon we were accommodated with a couple of bottles of that potato spirit sophisticated with brown sugar that goes by the name of rum in Austria, but which is not to be confused with rum. I set to work on this foundation to make myself popular. It is not hard to be popular with any group, whether composed of the most conventional Canadians or of Central European freaks, if one is prepared to talk to people about themselves. In an hour, I had heard about the Heterodelphian's daughter, who sang in a light opera chorus in Vienna, and about his wife, who had unaccountably wearied of his multiple attractions. The dwarf, who was shy and not very bright, took to me because I saw that he had his fair share of the room. The human frog was a German and very cranky about war reparations, and I assured him that everybody in Canada thought they were a crying shame. I was not playing false with these poor people. They were off duty and wanted to be regarded as human beings, and I was quite ready to oblige. I became personal only with the bearded lady, to whom I spoke of my search for the truth about Uncumber. She was entranced by the story of the saint and insisted that I repeat it for all to hear. She took it as a tribute to bearded ladies in general, and began seriously to discuss having a new banner painted, in which she would advertise herself as Madame Villefort, and be depicted crucified, gazing sternly at the departing figure of a pagan fiancé. Indeed, this was my best card, but the strangeness of my quest seemed to qualify me as a freak myself, and make me more than ever one of the family. When we needed more room, I contrived that Paul should go for it. I judged that the time had come when his colleagues would talk to me about him. And so it was. "He stays with us only because of Le Solitaire," said the bearded lady. "I will not conceal from you, monsieur, that Le Solitaire is not a well man, nor could he travel alone. Faustus very properly acknowledges a debt of gratitude, for before Le Solitaire became so incapable that he was forced to adopt the undemanding role of un solitaire, he had his own show of which Faustus was a part, and Faustus regards Le Solitaire as his father in art, if you understand the professional expression. I think it was Le Solitaire who brought him home from America." It was a very merry evening, and before it was over I had danced with the bearded lady to music provided by the dwarf, who whistled a polka and drummed with his feet. The sight of a wooden-legged man dancing seemed hilariously funny to the artistes of the one-eyed little circus, as the room got to them. When we broke up, I had a short private conversation with Paul. "May I tell your mother that I have seen you?"
"I cannot prevent it, Monsieur Ramsay, but I see no point in it."
"Grief at losing you has made her very unwell."
"As I mean to remain lost, I do not see what good it would do to tell her about me."
"I am sorry you have so little feeling for her."
"She is part of a past that cannot be recovered or changed by anything I can do now. My father always told me it was my birth that robbed her of her sanity, so as a child I had to carry the weight of my mother's madness as something that was my own doing, and I had to bear the cruelty of people who thought her kind of madness was funny, a dirty joke. So far as I am concerned, it is over, and if she dies mad, who will not say that she is better dead?
So next morning I went on my journey in search of the truth about Uncumber, after I had made the necessary arrangements for more money. Because somebody at Le Grand Cirque Forain de Saint-Vite had stolen my pocketbook, and everything pointed to Paul.
Chapter 4 Gyges and King Candolles 1 Boy Staunton made a great deal of money during the Depression because he dealt extensively in solaces. When a man is down on his luck, he seems to consume all he can get of coffee and doughnuts. The sugar in the coffee was Boy's sugar, and the doughnuts were his doughnuts. When an overdriven woman without money to give her children a decent meal must give them something bulky, sweet, and interesting to stop their crying, she probably gives them a soft drink. It was Boy's soft drink. When a welfare agency wants to take the harsh look of bare necessity off a handout basket, it puts in a bag of candies for the children. They were Boy's candies. Behind tons of cheap confectionery, sweets, snacks, nibbles, biscuits, and simple cooking sugar, and the accompanying oceans of fizzy, sweet water disguised with chemical versions of every known fruit flavor, stood Boy Staunton, though not many people knew it. He was the president and managing director of Alpha Corporation, a much-respected company that made nothing itself but controlled all the other companies that did. He was busy and he was adventurous. When he first went into the bread business, because a large company was in difficulties and could be bought at a rock-bottom price, I asked him why he did not try beer as well. "I may do that when the economy is steadier," he said, "but at present I feel I should do everything I can to see that people have necessities." And we both took reflective pulls at the excellent whiskies and soda he had provided. Boy's new bread company made quite a public stir with their advertisements declaring that they would hold the price of bread steady. And they did so, though the loaves seemed to be a bit puffier and gassier than they had been before. We ate them at school, so I was able to judge. There was filial piety as well as altruism in Boy's decision. Old Doc Staunton's annoyance at being outsmarted by his son had given way to his cupidity, and the old man was a large holder in Alpha. To have associated him with beer would have made trouble, and Boy never looked for trouble. "Alpha concentrates on necessities," Boy liked to say. "In times like these, people need cheap, nourishing food. If a family can't buy meat, our vitaminized biscuits are still within their reach." So much so, indeed, that Boy was fast becoming one of the truly rich, by which I mean one of those men whose personal income, though large, is a trifling part of the huge, mystical body of wealth that stands behind them and cannot be counted, only estimated. A few cranky politicians of the most radical party tried to estimate it in order to show that, in some way, the very existence of Boy was intolerable in a country where people were in want. But, like so many idealists, they did not understand money, and after a meeting where they had lambasted Boy and others like him and threatened to confiscate their wealth at the first opportunity, they would adjourn to cheap restaurants where they drank his sugar and ate his sugar and smoked cigarettes which, had they known it, benefited some other monster they sought to destroy. I used to hear him abused by some of the junior masters at the school. They were Englishmen, or Canadians who had studied in England, and they were full of the wisdom of the London School of Economics and the doctrine of the New Statesman, copies of which used to limp into the common room about a month after publication. I have never been sure of my own political opinions. Historical studies and my fondness for myth and legend have always blunted my political partisanship. But it amused me to hear these poor fellows, working for terrible salaries, denouncing Boy and a handful of others as capitalists. They always stressed the middle syllables, this being a fashionable pronunciation of the period, and one that seemed to make rich men especially contemptible. I never raised my voice in protest, and none of my colleagues ever knew that I was personally acquainted with the capitalist whose good looks, elegant style of life, and somewhat gross success
made their own hard fortune, and their leather-elbowed jackets and world-weary flannel trousers seem pitiful. This was not disloyalty. Rather, it seemed to me that the boy they hated and did not know was unrelated to the boy I saw about once a fortnight, and often more frequently. I owed this position to the fact that I was the only person to whom he could talk frankly about Leola. She was trying hard, but she could not keep pace with boy's social advancement. He was a genius, that is to say, a man who does superlatively and without obvious effort something that most people cannot do by the uttermost exertion of their abilities. He was a genius at making money, and that is as uncommon as great achievement in the arts. The simplicity of his concepts and the masterly way in which they were carried through made jealous people say he was lucky, and people like my schoolmaster colleagues say he was a crook. But he made his own luck, and no breath of financial scandal ever came near him. His ambitions did not rest in finance alone. He had built firmly on his association with the Prince of Wales, and though in hard fact it did not amount to more than the reception of a monogrammed Christmas card once a year, it bulked substantially, though never quite to the point of absurdity, in his conversation. "He isn't joining them at Sandringham this year," he would say as Christmas drew near. "Pretty stuffy, I suppose." And somehow this suggested that he had some inside information, perhaps a personal letter, though everybody who read the newspapers knew as much. All boys' friends had to be pretty spry at knowing who he was, or they ceased to be friends. In a less glossily successful young man, this would have been laughable, but the people boy knew were not the kind of people who laughed at several million dollars. It was after David's birth it became clear that Leola was lagging in the upward climb. A woman can go just so far on the capital of being a pretty girl. Leola, like boy and myself, was now past youth. He was 2 months younger than I, though I looked older than 32, and